It's Friday, January 31st, and this is the fourth episode of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted, where I, John Zogby, and my son, Jeremy, son and partner, take a look at some of the hottest news of the week, both politically and not politically. And so I'm John Zogby, longtime pollster, longtime political observer, even way back when a political activist. And I am here joined by my son and partner at John Zogby Strategies, Jeremy.
And I'm Jeremy Zogby. I've taught history. I've worked in banking. I've worked in sales. And this June will be the fourth year as partner at John Zogby Strategies, although I do have to say I've always worked with you.
Yes, you have. Yep. And you've been upgraded to partner.
Okay. Looking forward to what's next.
Yeah, senior partner is next. I'll tell you, that's very enjoyable.
So we're going to pick up with a lot of the topics that we talked about last week. So we've had some major headways in Iowa, a lot of stuff that's happened in the last 7 days. So why don't we start off with Iowa? You recently penned an op-ed about what people need to understand about Iowa, the caucus, and what to expect as of lately.
So first of all, let me begin, as I did the op-ed, by saying I really like the Iowa caucuses. I think they represent the best in America's traditions. It's direct democracy, it's populist, it's traditional, it's unscripted, mysterious. You never know what the outcome is going to be. And I think that that's good. And I think it also represents an independence tradition among the American people. It's not as diverse as America is, but that independence makes it unpredictable. And I like that. What do people need to know? Look at the polls. And the polls are starting to send some messages. But the polls basically give us an idea of what the expectations should be going in. And then from there, during the caucuses, there's a lot of horse trading that goes on. There are candidates who will have to drop out because they don't meet a 15% threshold. And that dynamic in itself allows us to see not only who actually wins the Iowa caucuses, but who wins by enough, who didn't win by enough, who exceeded expectations, who maybe came in second place but was supposed to come in first place, or came in third place but was expected to be in seventh place. And that in itself makes it fascinating to me.
And I mean, really, we could say that Iowa is the first stop at intensity, meaning these candidates, they have to go around the state. They have to be going door to door. They have to be visiting neighborhoods. They have to be in school gymnasiums. Really, they get exposed. If they're not into it, the Iowans sense that right away. Is that right?
That's very true. And if you're going to be president of the United States, I think you need to run the gauntlet. You know, so that doesn't mean rings of fire, but it does mean humbling yourself. Running in the Iowa caucuses is really tantamount to running for town council. I mean, you're getting down to the basic level. You want to be the leader of the free world. You have to knock on doors. You have to be up at 5:30, 6 in the morning, not only shaking hands at factories and groups of farmers, but serving pancakes at pancake breakfasts, walking down one street where there are no people and seeing on the other side of the street a cluster of five people, and then jaywalking. I've seen that. Dick Gephardt, 1988, crossing the street because there's five people there to meet. Who knows? You could pick up two votes that you didn't have. I like that, and I like the fact that candidates have to expose themselves to that.
So what attribute, I mean, you've witnessed this over decades. In all of the history that you've observed, the Iowa caucus, what attribute stands out as the most important in a candidate to convince Iowans?
Authenticity, period. That's becoming more and more important. But basically, you need to be real, or at least who you are for real. And that's the sort of stuff that comes off at a pancake breakfast. If somebody's stiff and not good at flipping pancakes, not good at schmoozing with people, hey, can talk policy like a real policy wonk, but on the other hand, cannot talk the talk in the streets and the farms of Iowa, Iowans pick up on that. And so Iowa serves as first and foremost the winnowing out process. You know, you go in with 9, 10, 11 candidates perhaps, and you emerge maybe with a top 3 or 4. That's a service in and of itself. But then secondly, these are real people really voting and horse trading with each other. We kind of got into that last week. And now you're beginning to focus and get a good idea who the who are among the real nominees.
So we know from our poll that we released with Forbes of 18 to 29-year-old likely voters, we know that nationwide, this age cohort sees Bernie Sanders as the most authentic of the Democratic candidates. By your estimation, among all likely Democratic voters in Iowans, who do you think they're going to connect with as the most authentic?
It depends on turnout. Okay, so usually the average is 115,000, 120,000 people show up throughout the state at these caucuses. Barack Obama alone drove that to 140, almost 150,000. If we see a turnout greater than that, then that means that young people have turned out. If young people turn out, then Bernie Sanders wins and wins handily. And frankly, even though I shouldn't make predictions, the fact that he's leading in almost, not quite every, but almost every poll, and leading substantially by very intense support by young people, I think he's going to do very, very well.
We can definitely see why the young see Bernie as authentic. He basically hasn't changed his position as long as he's been in politics, right?
Never.
As far back as I can go in knowing about Bernie Sanders, it's the same thing.
As far back as Papa can go, it's the same thing.
And actually, I'd like to give you this opportunity because I've heard this story maybe 15 times now, but it never gets old. I would like to hear it a 16th time, and I'd like our listeners to know about this. Tell everybody your first encounter with Bernie Sanders, when this was, what you were doing.
So I ran for mayor of Utica, a city of about 70,000 people in 1981, and I lost, thank God. And Bernie Sanders ran for mayor of Burlington same year, and he won. City about the same size. So the next year, we're both invited to Cornell, an urban affairs institute, to talk about the future of small cities. And we're in an auditorium, about 400 people are there. There's a baby crying in the back of the room. I get up and talk. 1981, I was accustomed to babies at home crying, you know. And I finished. Bernie gets up, and baby's still crying. Bernie gets out about two sentences. And then he says, "That baby in the back is very disturbing. Could somebody shut that baby up?" And this poor lady in the back just gets up, you know, this was an infant that was crying, and just walked out very sheepishly. And I thought back then that, you know, maybe he was good and solid on the issues, but he was kind of lacking. It was not a charming moment. Let's put it that way.
Well, let's hope 39 years later that we don't repeat the same thing. Take note, Bernie. So we have you have some potential scenarios.
Yes.
Let's go over some of those. What's scenario one? What do you think is the most likely scenario as of right now?
As of right now, that Bernie Sanders wins in Iowa and wins handily in Iowa. I suspect that that Joe Biden comes in second place, and that Amy Klobuchar comes in third place. In that scenario, then those three live on into New Hampshire, where Bernie is leading in every poll in New Hampshire. Biden is in third place. Klobuchar is down a bit. But if this scenario holds out, that he wins Iowa and probably wins New Hampshire, here's what happens. I think that effectively knocks Elizabeth Warren out of the race because she's not doing very well in her neighboring state. I think it knocks Pete Buttigieg out of the race, too. I don't think you can recover from a fourth or even a third place in Iowa. And then from there, we're starting to see that Bernie is picking up support among younger African Americans. Now, that's significant because at the end of this month, February 29th, on a Saturday, is the South Carolina primary. 60% of the vote is African American, and that's supposed to be Joe Biden's firewall, that he wins big. He's the only one doing very well among African American voters. So Biden is supposed to be able to not win Iowa, New Hampshire, but then go on to South Carolina and mop up. If Bernie wins these first two contests, which I think he will, and is picking up enough younger African Americans to chip away at some of Biden's support, that's enough for him to do respectably in South Carolina. And then from there, Democrats, the establishment, the Democratic Party, have got to then find the ABB candidate, anybody but Bernie.
How do you think the establishment of the Democratic Party feels about Bernie winning Iowa and then New Hampshire?
The establishment does not like Bernie. You know that there is a strong case that the Sanders people made back in 2016 that the decks were stacked against Bernie, and there's really plenty of evidence that was the case. I think they fear that a Bernie Sanders nomination is tantamount to a George McGovern situation, where somebody wins the left of the party, but brings the party so far to the left that it alienates moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans, and that Donald Trump wins re-election in a landslide.
In that scenario where Bernie takes off, who does the DCCC want as his VP?
So what I believe happens next is if Biden, in fact, recovers under this scenario in South Carolina and is picking up lots of delegates and strikes a deal with Klobuchar that she'll support Biden, then it becomes a Sanders versus Biden race. Remember, there are going to be two Democrats, a progressive and a moderate, going to the convention in Milwaukee in July. If Biden is seen as damaged goods, that then is supposed to be the Bloomberg scenario, where Bloomberg, of course, is not really campaigning in any of the early states, is campaigning vigorously in Super Tuesday, March 3rd. That's a very strange scenario. No one's ever been able to do that before and then jump in, but that could be the Bloomberg scenario, in which case then this becomes a battle, almost a race for the death of the Democratic Party. Because if I'm Bernie and I'm running against that 1%, the billionaires who don't pay their fair share, who do I want to run against for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party? Answer, a billionaire. Mm-hmm. And that's like made to order for Bernie, made to order for Bloomberg to run against the left-wing socialist, but not good for the party.
So rolling with the scenario that Bernie is the choice and then it becomes Bernie versus Donald Trump, I'm of the opinion that that's better for the Democratic Party because I envision a Biden nomination up against Trump becomes a lot of who can expose the most dirt. Mm. To me, and by my estimation, Bernie is more of the issues policy guy, And not to say that he wouldn't sling mud. I'm sure he can do that and do it with the best of them. But it becomes a battle of ideologies.
Mm-hmm.
The future of America. Here we are. It becomes we're at a fork in the road. Do we become socialist America or do we stick to capitalist America? What does it look like with Biden versus Trump? Do you agree with what I just laid out there?
I can see it, but not necessarily. In fact, I think in many ways, Bernie has the potential to not crawl into the sewer with Donald Trump, and to be above that fray and to focus on issues. The issue is, as a progressive and as a socialist, that where he can turn on younger voters, 18, I'm going to say 18 to 40 year olds anyway, the fear then is that he alienates older voters who think of socialism a lot differently than people under 40 do. People under 40 don't recall the Soviet Union, don't recall the worst days of Castro, and so on. Those over 40, and especially the older you get, do. Now, what about a Biden scenario? To me, he's the one guy who can stand on the stage with Donald Trump and say, "Shut up, Donald. Everybody's tired of you," and have the gravitas. He's also, in terms of authenticity, even though he's been in Washington for 100 years, there is a perception that he's Uncle Joe, and very affable sort of retail politician.
Is Biden the candidate that can sustain the substance on his issues or his command of his issues like Bernie can over the course of a year?
Well, he is a policy person. He's made a lot of policies. There are some that, that both Donald Trump and progressives will make hay with. He was author of the crime bill, very controversial crime bill. He's the one, if you want to talk about women, he's the one who went after Anita Hill during the Clarence Thomas issue. He's the one who likes to rub shoulders and smell the back of women's heads, which is kind of eerie. There are some clear vulnerabilities there that Biden has. On the other hand, I think he's got the gravitas. I do believe if it's not Biden, and it should be a moderate, and I'm just playing out scenarios here, not endorsing, but that probably Klobuchar is the one, very serious, very successful legislator, and a premier debater. Arguably, she has won most of the Democratic debates and handled the Brett Kavanaugh situation, I think, better than any other senator did.
Moving on to our next topic, we're going to talk about some research that we did towards the end of 2019. You could say the first of its kind. Of course, artificial intelligence is has been a hot topic for the last several years, but who has really polled those who will have to face it when we get to that point when the workplace transitions? So we did a study of 18 to 40 year olds in the workplace in three nations: United States, Canada, and Mexico. We polled 1,000 in the U.S. and 900 in both Mexico and Canada. Just to go over some of the top line data here, we found that overall more than half of this group in America, of the 18 to 40 year olds, that would be 54%, feel that the introduction of artificial intelligence into the workplace is more of a good thing. In Canada, 52% felt that way. And then in Mexico, 76% felt that way. So the numbers show that there is a readiness and anticipation and not so much a view that the Terminator is around the corner. You, as a CEO, what does that mean to you?
Well, clearly, as a pollster, that was my business, that is my business. We had to adjust to new technologies. We were seeing a telephone, landline telephone technology imploding. And, you know, significant pace of growth of online access. And so we began 20 plus years ago doing research and development and online. We needed to be ready for new technologies. We'd bring teams, as you remember, because you coordinated them for a couple of summers, interns to come in. And interns were constantly experimenting in the workplace, taught me a lot, you know, in terms of, hey, we can't do business the way we've been doing business before. So what this tells me, first of all, is that the workforce, as a CEO, I've got to see the workforce as of that age now where their entire lives have been either adjusting rapidly to new technologies or being ahead of leading those new technologies. And that tells me I'll fall behind if I don't enable this. We should say, before I turn this back to you, that the client here was the Center for Global Enterprise, which includes the former senior leadership at IBM. And this organization is devoted to assisting and training CEOs and C-suite executives in adjusting to the rapid changes that AI and machine learning are going to bring to the workplace. We found some other incredible things as well.
Yeah, the thing that jumped out the most to me let me back up and say that when we were writing the survey instrument, I know you wanted to know this as well, but especially I wanted to know what degree do 18 to 40 year olds prefer a traditional hierarchical form of leadership versus something that's more distributive and collaborative. By and large, in all three nations, this group, by no surprise, preferred the distributive collaborative models. That made me realize there are probably many CEOs who are used to decades of the hierarchical system. That might be a difficult transition. How do they begin to entrust their workers to ready themselves? How does that work?
I still don't see, and you and I have talked about this, it's hard to see CEOs just automatically rolling over or readjusting the structure of the company. What I like about all survey results, you know, the unpredictable, but what I liked about this one is that there was a nuance here. So the young people were saying, look, when it comes to my career, my future, my productivity, things that involve my path forward, I want it to be distributive and horizontal. When it comes to identifying new markets and serving those markets in the best possible way, then I prefer the hierarchical. I think that that's a fascinating transition there.
I mean, in other words, the leadership, you are experts in the area of crises, in finding new markets. You deal with that. I'm the expert of myself and how to work with my peer. So where the introduction of AI most affects me and my colleagues, we can take the lead on this. But in the external aspects, they still want the traditional hierarchical model.
That's a bridge to the future. Mm-hmm. And the future is not 20 years from now. The future is Monday morning, as far as these companies are concerned. But I think that hopefully makes this less of a daunting task for today's CEOs. If they could see these results and recognize then, hey, there's a path forward without my having to step down or blow up the C-suite.
Let's talk about the three cohorts. So when we did these three nations, we crunched the numbers and we segmented them into three groups. The first group would be called the leaders. In each nation, they're roughly about 10% of the population. They have the skills, they have the leadership capacity, they have the desire to drive major workforce and societal transformations brought about by AI. So they're not to be worried about. They're doing okay. The next group, the adapters, we call them, by far the most abundant. They came out at 59% in the U.S., 65% in Canada, mm-hmm. and almost 74% in Mexico. Why do you say that they will need some nurturing?
Because they could go either way. What they showed is that they have some training. They have the desire in some ways, anyway, they have the capacity. Maybe what's missing is either a lack of ongoing training, because this is going to require a lot of training, and or a lack of confidence. And so that is going to mean that these companies are going to have to identify the adapters and ensure by offering the kinds of training options and continuous learning options that they make the transition smoothly, as opposed to the third group that we identified, the at-risk. About 1 in 4 in the U.S. and Canada, and about 1 in 6 in Mexico, who lack the training, lack the desire, and
even told us in basically their own words that they don't feel that they can make the transition.
Yeah.
We're talking about between the three countries, almost a fifth of each nation. What do CEOs have to do Monday morning?
Monday morning, they have to identify the leaders, because it's the leaders who are actually going to make this transition. Typical CEO is not steeped in artificial intelligence, in machine learning. They do other things. So identify the leaders, because they're the ones who say, hey, we're ready to push this along. The leaders then in turn identify the adapters and create what it is that the adapters want. In some instances, they told us they want training right on the job. In other instances, what they said was they want online courses, more and more online courses. Some even preferred on-campus courses, but those things have to be plotted out as part of a plan immediately. As far as the at-risk are concerned, that is still a substantial number. That's the thing that's going to take a large public as well as private commitment. That's where government comes in. That's where community colleges come in. That's where that comes under the category of cutting your losses. I mean, we actually listened, right, to these people or read what it was that they had to say online, and they were telling us, I fear it, I don't know it, I'm not ready for it, but we can't afford to just write them off and say we're going to lose all of them, because losing in the next economy can really mean losing.
And so here we are at our final topic, and this was our final topic last week. By far, the biggest story of the week, the coronavirus in China. I've heard all different kinds of figures. I think the latest right now as far as official cases is above 7,000.
It's over 8,000, actually.
Over 8,000. And deaths now are up to over 170. We officially have a case in the U.S. We officially have a case in the U.K., it's moved into a lot of other nations, and now the response has been the cancellations from the airlines of all flights going to and from China. Yesterday, the WHO declared it a public emergency of international concern. I thought it was interesting that they didn't go straight to the term pandemic. Mm-hmm. Which I believe SARS back in 2003 reached that official label. The head of the WHO continued to say that China was doing more than it was required to do and is setting a new standard there are about 50 million people who are under lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, the WHO, the head, doesn't recommend any travel or trade restrictions. I saw that in the press conference yesterday. That seemed to be a glaring contradiction.
This is, politics always enters into this, but then so do economics as well. And so if you're talking about shutting down travel and shutting down companies, you're talking about a decline in productivity and grinding an economy to a halt, which creates a whole different sort of problem. So for the moment anyway, they're trying to tamp down the fears and not get to that stage where you can create a panic.
Yeah.
And not just an economic panic,
yeah.
You know, but a...
Yeah, it's fascinating to... the same terminology is used in pathology.
Yep.
Is pretty much used in the markets, in the study of finance. Contagion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's precisely what you're saying. Is the more fear that there is all over the world, and we see that increasing in just 1 week, every day, the fear increasing, the more the markets have a tendency to panic.
So and we're in 19 countries now. Last I heard, 5 cases in the U.S., but the most recent case is the troubling one, because that was passed from someone who had been to Wuhan humanly to her husband,
mm-hmm.
Which means it was passed along through the eyes somehow. When we start getting into that, the fear is that, you know, we start to see those little lights on the screen pop up here and there and everywhere. That's the sort of thing that can create a panic. Very significant that WHO has issued this global warning.
So beyond the obvious scare of increasing deaths and the potential for markets to roil in reaction to this, the bigger implication, though, for the globe is this event, or let me put it in the form of a question, could this event bring about a new discussion on sovereignty?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I was going to get into that, which is interesting, because for all the, say, praise that China is getting, China also has declared we will not be part of any global intervention that includes Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's totally uncalled for in a situation like this. You're going to see that crop up, where sworn enemies are going to say, well, if you're participating, then I'm not going to participate, which then does beg the question, who will be the higher authority in all this and who can make decisions? And global governance is probably something that's going to be on the table.
So we're going to end it here. And these stories we'll be tracking, and we may or may not get to them next week, depending on what happens. So we'll see you next time.
We'll see you next time. And please feel free to comment. You know, go to our website and click on, that's johnzogbystrategies.com. Click on the podcast. There's a comment page. Let us know if you like this or you didn't like it or whatever, but we'd love to hear from you. And thank you.
Regarding the study that we cited with CGE, the Center for Global Enterprise on AI and Workforce Readiness in the 3-nation survey we did, you could go to www.thecge.net and look for the New Enlightenment Initiative. You should find our full report.
Excellent. Next week.
Next week.
Bye-bye.